The true pure blackout does nothing. Nothing to recall.
In one of the earliest studies of blackouts, an alcohol researcher named Donald Goodwin gathered 10 men from an unemployment line in St. Louis, gave them each the better part of a bottle of bourbon over a four-hour period, then had them perform a series of memory tests. Goodwin writes, "One such event was to show the person a frying pan with a lid on it, suggest that he might be hungry, take off the lid, and there in the pan are three dead mice. It can be said with confidence that sober individuals will remember this experience, probably for the rest of their lives." But the bourbon drinkers? Nothing. Not 30 minutes later, and not the next morning. The three dead mice never got recorded at all. In a blackout state, in that window of extreme drunkenness before their hippocampus comes back online, drunks are like ciphers, moving through the world without retaining anything. Goodwin once began an essay on blackouts with the following story. A 39-year-old salesman awoke in a strange hotel room. He had a mild hangover, but otherwise felt normal. His clothes were hanging in the closet. He was clean-shaven. He dressed and went down to the lobby. He learned from the clerk that he was in Las Vegas, and he had checked in 2 days previously. It had been obvious that he had been drinking, the clerk said, but he had not seemed very drunk. The date was Saturday the 14th. His last recollection was of sitting in a St. Louis bar on Monday the 9th. He had been drinking all day and was drunk, but could remember everything perfectly until about 3 p.m. when, quote, like a curtain dropping, quote, his memory went blank. It remained blank for approximately 5 days. 3 years later, it was still blank. He was so frightened by the experience that he abstained from alcohol for 2 years. The salesman had left the bar in St. Louis, gone to the airport, bought a plane ticket, flown to Las Vegas, found a hotel, checked in, hung up his suit, shaved, and apparently functioned perfectly well in the world, all while in blackout mode. That's the way blackouts work. At or around the 0.15 mark, the hippocampus shuts down and memories stop forming, but it is entirely possible that the frontal lobes, cerebellum, and amygdala of that same drinker, at the same time, can continue to function more or less normally.
You can do anything in a blackout that you can do when you're drunk. You're just not going to remember it. That could be, again, ordering stuff on Amazon. People tell me this all the time, you know. People can do very complicated things, buy tickets, travel, all kinds of things, and not remember.
It follows that it's really hard to tell, just by looking at someone, whether they've blacked out. It's like trying to figure out if someone has a headache exclusively from the expression on their face.
I might look a little drunk. I might look wasted. But I can talk to you. I can have a conversation with you. I can go get us drinks. I can do things that require short-term storage of information. I can talk to you about our growing up together and wherever, we, you know. Even wives of hardcore alcoholics say they can't really tell when their spouse is or is not in a blackout.
When Goodwin was doing his pioneering work in the 1960s, he assumed that only alcoholics got blackout drunk, that blackouts were rare. Scientists wrote about them in medical journals the way they would about a previously unknown disease. One of the first comprehensive surveys of college drinking habits was conducted in the late 1940s and early 50s at 27 colleges around the United States. Students were asked how much they drank, on average, at a sitting. For the purposes of this question, drinking amounts were divided into three groups. Smaller meant no more than two glasses of wine, two bottles of beer, or two mixed drinks. Medium was from three to five beers or glasses of wine, or three to four mixed drinks. And larger was anything above that. Very few respondents answered larger back then, especially women. Today, two things have changed. First, the heavy drinkers of today drink far more than the heavy drinkers of 50 years ago. When you talk to students today about four drinks or five drinks, they just sort of go, "Oof, that's just getting started," reports alcohol researcher Kim Frommi. She says that the heavy binge drinking category now routinely includes people who have had 20 drinks in a sitting. Blackouts, once rare, have become common. Aaron White recently surveyed more than 700 students at Duke University. Of the drinkers in the group, over half had suffered a blackout at some point in their lives. 40% had had a blackout in the previous year, and almost 1 in 10 had had a blackout in the previous 2 weeks. Second, the consumption gap between men and women, so pronounced a generation ago, has narrowed considerably, particularly among white women. The same trends aren't nearly as marked among Asians, Hispanics, or African Americans. I asked Kim Frommi about this.
I think it's an empowerment issue. I see it. I do a lot of consulting work in the military, and it's easier for me to see it there, quite frankly, than it is in the college environment, because in the military, you know, the women are really put to the same, you know, standards as men in terms of, you know, their physical, you know, boot camps and training and all of that. And they've worked very hard to try to say, we're like the men, you know, and therefore we can drink like the men.
For physiological reasons, this trend has put women at greatly increased risk for blackouts. If a male of average weight has 8 drinks over 4 hours, which would make him a moderate drinker at a typical frat party, he would end up with a blood alcohol reading of 0.107. That's too drunk to drive, but well below the 0.15 level typically associated with blackouts. If a woman of average weight has 8 drinks over 4 hours, by contrast, she's at a blood alcohol level of 0.173. She's blacked out. It gets worse, Aaron White says. Women are also increasingly drinking wine and spirits, which raise blood alcohol concentration, or BAC, much faster than beer.
Women are also more likely to skip meals when they drink than men, although men do it too. And having a meal in your stomach when you drink reduces your peak BAC by about a third. So in other words, if you drink on an empty stomach, you're going to reach a much higher BAC, and you're going to do it much more quickly.
Nor is it just a matter of weight. There are also meaningful differences in the way the sexes metabolize alcohol. Women have much less water in their bodies than men, with the result that alcohol enters their bloodstream much more quickly. And what is the consequence of being blacked out? It means that women are put in a position of vulnerability. Our memory in any interaction with a stranger is our first line of defense. We talk to someone at a party for half an hour and weigh what we've learned. We use our memory to make sense of who the other person is. We collect things they've told us and done, and those shape our response. That is not an error-free exercise in the best of times, but it is a necessary exercise, particularly if the issue at hand is whether you're going to go home with a person. Yet, if you can't remember anything you've just learned, you are necessarily not making the same quality decision you would have if your hippocampus were still working. You have ceded control of the situation. Let's be totally clear. Perpetrators are the ones responsible for committing their crimes, and they should be brought to justice. Critic Emily Yaffe writes in Slate. But we are failing to let women know that when they render themselves defenseless, terrible things can be done to them. Young women are getting a distorted message that their right to match men drink for drink is a feminist issue. The real feminist message should be that when you lose the ability to be responsible for yourself, you drastically increase the chances that you will attract the kinds of people who, shall we say, don't have your best interest at heart. That's not blaming the victim. That's trying to prevent more victims. And what of the stranger talking to you? He may not know that you are blacked out. Maybe he leans in and tries to touch you, and you stiffen. Then, 10 minutes later, he circles back a little more artfully. Normally, you would stiffen again because you would recognize the stranger's pattern. But you don't this second time because you don't remember the first time. And the fact that you don't stiffen in quite the same way makes the stranger think, under the assumption of transparency, that you are welcoming his advances. Normally, he would be cautious in acting on that assumption, Friendliness is not the same thing as an invitation to intimacy, but he's drunk too. He's in the grip of alcohol myopia and the kind of longer-term considerations that might otherwise constrain his behavior have faded from view. Does alcohol turn every man into a monster? Of course not. Myopia resolves high conflict. It removes the higher-order constraints on our behavior. The reserved man, normally too shy to profess his feelings, might blurt out some intimacy. The unfunny man, normally aware that the world does not find his jokes funny, might start playing comedian. Those are harmless. But what of the sexually aggressive teenager, whose impulses are normally kept in check by an understanding of how inappropriate those behaviors are? Young men are getting a distorted message that drinking to excess is a harmless social exercise, Yaffe writes. The real message should be that when you lose the ability to be responsible for yourself, you drastically increase the chances you will commit a sexual crime. Acknowledging the role of alcohol is not excusing the behavior of perpetrators. It is trying to prevent more young men from becoming perpetrators. It is striking how underappreciated the power of myopia is. In the Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation study, students were asked to list the measures they thought would be most effective in reducing sexual assault. At the top of that list, they put harsher punishment for aggressors, self-defense training for victims, and teaching men to respect women more. How many thought it would be very effective if they drank less? 33%. How many thought stronger restrictions on alcohol on campus would be very effective? 15%. These are contradictory positions. Students think it's a good idea to be trained in self-defense and not such a good idea to clamp down on drinking. But what good is knowing the techniques of self-defense if you're blind drunk? Students think it's a really good idea if men respect women more. But the issue with many cases of campus sexual assault is not how men behave around women when they're sober. It's how they behave around women when they're drunk and have been transformed by alcohol into a person who makes sense of the world around them very differently. Respect for others requires a complicated calculation in which one party agrees to moderate their own desires, to consider the longer-term consequences of their own behavior, to think about something other than the thing right in front of them. And that is exactly what the myopia that comes with drunkenness makes it so hard to do. The lesson of myopia is really very simple. If you want people to be themselves in a social encounter with a stranger, to represent their own desires honestly and clearly, they cannot be blind drunk. And if they are blind drunk, and therefore at the mercy of their environment, the worst possible place to be is an environment where men and women are grinding on the dance floor and jumping on the tables. A Kappa Alpha fraternity party is not a Kanban drinking circle. Persons learn about drunkenness, what their societies import to them, and comporting themselves in consonance with these understandings, they become living confirmations of their society's teachings. Craig McAndrew and Robert Edgerton conclude in their classic 1969 work, Drunken Comportment. Since societies, like individuals, get the sorts of drunken comportment that they allow, they deserve what they get. So, at the Kappa Alpha party at Stanford, sometime just after midnight, Emily Doe suffered a blackout. That's what happens when you begin your evening with a light dinner and four quick shots of whiskey and a glass of champagne, followed by three or four shots of vodka in a red solo cup.
And at some point, do you recall your sister leaving the party?
I do not.
What is your next memory after going to the bathroom outside, coming back to the patio, having the beers, and seeing some of the guys shotgun some beers?
I woke up in the hospital.
Emily Doe has no memory of meeting Brock Turner, no memory of whether she did or didn't dance with him, no memory of whether she did or didn't kiss him, did or didn't agree to go back to his dorm, and no memory of whether she was a willing or unwilling participant in their sexual activity. Did she resist when they left the party? Did she struggle? Did she flirt with him? Did she just stumble blindly after him? We'll never know. After the fact, when she was sober, Doe was adamant that she would never have willingly left the party with another man. She was in a committed relationship. But it wasn't the real Emily Doe who met Brock Turner. It was drunk and blacked out Emily Doe. And our drunken, blacked out selves are not the same as our sober selves. Brock Turner claimed to remember what happened that night, and that at every step of the way, Emily Doe was a willing participant. But that is the story he told at his trial, after months of prepping and strategizing with his lawyers. On the night of his arrest, as he sat in shock in the interview room of the local police station, he had none of that certainty about Emily Doe.
Were you guys hooking up there before or before you even moved over?
I think so, but I'm not sure when we started kissing, honestly.
Then the police officer asks him why he ran when the two graduate students discovered him and Emily Doe on the ground.
I don't think I ran.
You don't remember running?
No.
Keep in mind that the event in question just happened earlier that night, and that even as he is speaking, Turner is nursing an injured wrist from when he was tackled as he tried to escape.
Did you get a look at her while she... this was going on, while the guys were approaching you and talking to you?
No.
Is it possible she was unresponsive at that point?
Honestly, I don't know, because I really don't remember. Like, I think I was kind of blacked out after, from the point of me going, like, hooking up to her to, like, me being on the ground with the other guys. Like, I really don't remember how that happened.
I think I was kind of blacked out. So the whole story about flirting and kissing and Emily Doe agreeing to go back to his dorm was a fiction. It was what he hoped had happened. What actually happened will be forever a mystery. Maybe Turner and Emily Doe just stood there on the dance floor, repeating the same things to each other over and over again, without realizing they were trapped in an infinite blacked-out loop. At the end of the trial, Emily Doe read a letter out loud to the court, addressed to Brock Turner. Every young man and woman who goes to a bar or a fraternity party should read Emily Doe's letter. It is brave and eloquent and a powerful reminder of the consequences of sexual assault, that what happens between two strangers in the absence of real consent causes genuine pain and suffering. What happened that night, she said, shattered her.
My independence, natural joy, gentleness, and steady lifestyle I'd been enjoying became distorted beyond recognition. I became closed off, angry, self-deprecating, tired, irritable, empty. The isolation was at times unbearable.
At work, she would show up late, then go and cry in the stairwell. She would cry herself to sleep at night, and in the morning, hold refrigerated spoons to her eyes to lessen the swelling.
I can't sleep alone at night without having a light on, like a 5-year-old, because I have nightmares of being touched where I cannot wake up. I did this thing where I waited until the sun came up and I felt safe enough to sleep. For 3 months, I went to bed at 6 o'clock in the morning. I used to pride myself on my independence. Now I'm afraid to go on walks in the evening, to attend social events with drinking among friends where I should be comfortable being. I have become a little barnacle, always needing to be at someone's side, to have my boyfriend standing next to me, sleeping beside me, protecting me. It's embarrassing how feeble I feel, how timidly I move through life, always guarded, ready to defend myself, ready to be angry.
Then she comes to the question of alcohol. Was it a factor in what happened that night? Of course. But then she says,
alcohol was not the one who stripped me, fingered me, had my head dragging against the ground with me almost fully naked. Having too much to drink was an amateur mistake that I admit to, but it is not criminal. Everyone in this room has had a night where they regretted drinking too much or knows someone close to them who's had a night where they regretted drinking too much. Regretting drinking is not the same as regretting sexual assault. We were both drunk. The difference is I did not take off your pants and underwear, touch you inappropriately, and run away. That's the difference.
In his own statement to the court, Turner had said he was hoping to set up a program for students to, quote, speak out against the campus drinking culture and sexual promiscuity that goes along with that. Doe was scathing.
Campus drinking culture? That's what we're speaking out against? You think that's what I've spent the past year fighting for? Not awareness about campus sexual assault or rape or learning to recognize consent? Campus drinking culture. Down with Jack Daniels, down with Sky Vodka. If you want to talk about people drinking, go to an AA meeting. You realize having a drinking problem is different than drinking and then forcefully trying to have sex with someone? Show men how to respect women, not how to drink less.
But what if that last line were, show men how to respect women and how to drink less? Because the two things are connected. Brock Turner had to do something of crucial importance that night to make sense of a stranger's desires and motivations. That is a hard task for all of us under the best of circumstances, because the assumption of transparency we rely on in those encounters is so flawed. Asking a drunk and immature 19-year-old to do that in the hypersexualized chaos of a frat party is an invitation to disaster. The outcome of People versus Brock Turner brought a measure of justice to Emily Doe. But so long as we refuse to acknowledge what alcohol does to the interaction between strangers, that evening at Kappa Alpha will be repeated again and again.
You've heard that voicemail of Emily, haven't you?
Yes.
Turner is being cross-examined by the prosecutor. She's referring to the slurred phone call Emily Doe made to her boyfriend sometime after she blacked out.
You would agree with me that in that voicemail, she sounds super intoxicated?
Yes.
That's how she was with you that night, wasn't she?
Yes.
She was very drunk, wasn't she?
Not more than anybody else that I had been with.
Part 4. Lessons. Chapter 9. KSM. What happens when a stranger is a terrorist?
My first thought was that he looked like a troll.
This is a man named James Mitchell, remembering a very specific encounter with a stranger.
He was angry, he was belligerent, he was glaring at me. You know, and I'm doing a neutral probe, so I'm talking to him basically like I'm talking to you. I took the hood off, and I said, what would you like me to call you?
The man answered in accented English, call me Mukhtar. Mukhtar means the brain. I was the Amir of the 9/11 attacks. It was March 2003 in a CIA black site somewhere on the other side of the world, Mitchell said. Mukhtar was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or KSM, as he was otherwise known. One of the most senior Al-Qaeda officials ever captured. He was naked, hands and feet shackled, yet defiant.
They had shaved his head, I think, by that point, and shaved his beard. But he just was the hairiest person I'd ever seen in my life. And little, we're little. He had a huge, like, Vietnamese pot-bellied pig belly. And that was my first impression. I thought, this guy killed all those Americans?
Mitchell has a runner's build, tall and slender, with longish white hair parted in the middle and a neatly trimmed beard. He describes himself as looking like some guy's uncle, which is perhaps overly self-deprecating. He gives off a sense of unshakable self-confidence, as if he always gets a good night's sleep, no matter what he did to anyone that day or what anyone did to him. Mitchell is a psychologist by training. After 9/11, he and a colleague, Bruce Jessen, were brought in by the CIA because of their special skills in high-stakes interrogation. Jessen is bigger than Mitchell, quieter, with a cropped military haircut. Mitchell says Jessen looks like an older Jean-Claude Van Damme. Jessen does not speak publicly. If you hunt around online, you can find portions of a videotaped deposition he and Mitchell once gave in a lawsuit arising from their interrogation practices. In the deposition, Mitchell is unruffled, discursive, almost contemptuous of the proceedings. Jessen is terse and guarded. "We were soldiers doing what we were instructed to do," he says. Their first assignment after the towers fell was to help interrogate Abu Zubaydah, one of the first high-level Al-Qaeda operatives to be captured. They would go on to personally question many other high-value suspected terrorists over 8 years in a variety of black sites all over the world. Of them all, KSM was the biggest prize.
It just struck me as being brilliant. When he would say to me, when I would ask him a question, and he would say, "That's not the question I would ask." He said, "You'll get an answer and you'll find it useful and you'll think that's all you need. But really the question I would ask is this question."
Mitchell says he would then ask KSM's question of KSM himself. KSM would hold forth on the tactics of terrorist engagement, on his strategic vision, on the goals of jihad. Had he not been captured, KSM had all manner of follow-ups to 9/11 planned.
I would ask him the question, and he would give a much more detailed, much more global answer. You know what I mean? An answer that encompassed principles. His descriptions of the low-tech lone wolf attacks were horrifying. And the fact that he sets around and thinks about economy of scale when it comes to killing people.
Here, Mitchell shakes his head.
He completely creeped me out when he was talking about Daniel Pearl. I mean, that was the most, I cried and still do because it was horrific.
Daniel Pearl was the Wall Street Journal reporter kidnapped and then killed in Pakistan in January 2002. KSM brought up the subject of Pearl without being asked, then got out of his chair and demonstrated, with what Mitchell thought was a touch of relish, the technique he had used in beheading Pearl with a knife.
What was horrific about it was he acted like he had some sort of an intimate relationship with Daniel. He kept calling him Daniel in that voice, like they were not really lovers, but they were best friends or something. It was just the creepiest thing.
But that was all later, after KSM opened up. In March 2003, when Mitchell and Jessen first confronted him, tiny and hairy and pot-bellied, things were very different.
Because you got to remember, at that particular time, they had credible evidence that Al-Qaeda had another big wave of attacks coming, but there was a lot of chatter. They knew that Osama bin Laden had met with the Pakistani scientists who were passing out nuclear technology, and they knew that the Pakistani scientists had said to bin Laden, you know, the biggest problem is getting the nuclear material. And bin Laden had said, what if we've already got it? And that just sent chills through the, you know, through the whole intelligence community.
Keep in mind, this was 2003. The CIA had people walking around Manhattan with Geiger counters looking for a dirty bomb. Washington was on high alert. And when KSM was first captured, the feeling was that if anyone knew anything about the planned attacks, it would be him. But KSM wasn't talking back then, and Mitchell wasn't optimistic. KSM was a hard case. The first set of interrogators sent to question KSM had tried to be friendly. They'd made him comfortable and brewed him some tea and asked respectful questions. They'd gotten nowhere. He'd simply looked at them and rocked back and forth. Then KSM had been handed over to someone Mitchell calls the new sheriff in town, an interrogator whom Mitchell says crossed the line into sadism, contorting KSM into a variety of stress positions, like taping his hands together behind his back, then raising them up over his head so that his shoulders almost popped out.
This guy had told me that he had learned his interrogation approaches in South America from the anti-communist rebels. The new sheriff had this idea that he wanted to be called sir. That's all he focused on because he thought he had to break them.
KSM had no intention of calling anyone sir. After a week of trying, the new sheriff gave up. The prisoner was handed over to James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. What happened next is a matter of great controversy. The methods of interrogation used on KSM have been the subject of lawsuits, congressional investigations, and endless public debate. Those who approve refer to the measures as enhanced interrogation techniques, EITs. Those on the other side call them torture. But let us leave aside those broader ethical questions for a moment and focus on what the interrogation of KSM can tell us about the underlying problem we have in making sense of people we do not know. Default to truth is a crucially important strategy that occasionally and unavoidably leads us astray. Transparency is a seemingly common sense assumption that turns out to be an illusion. Both, however, raise the same question. Once we accept our shortcomings, what should we do? Before we return to Sandra Bland and what exactly happened on that roadside in Texas, I want to talk about perhaps the most extreme version of the talking to strangers problem. A terrorist who wants to hold on to his secrets and an interrogator who is willing to go to almost any length to pry them free. Mitchell and Jessen met in Spokane, Washington, where they were both staff psychologists for the Air Force's SEER program. SEER stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. All branches of the U.S. military have their own versions of SEER, which involves teaching key personnel what to do in the event that they fall into enemy hands. The exercise would begin with the local police rounding up Air Force officers, unannounced, and bringing them to a detention center mocked up as an enemy POW camp.
They just stop them and arrest them, and then they hand them over to whoever whoever's going to do the operational readiness test.
One exercise involved crews of the bombers that carry nuclear weapons. Everything about their mission was classified. If they were to crash in hostile territory, you can imagine how curious their captors would be about the contents of their planes. The SEER program was supposed to prepare a flight crew for what might happen. The subjects would be cold, hungry, forced to stand awake inside a box for days. Then came the interrogation. You would see if you could try and extract that information from them, Mitchell said. He says it was very realistic. One particularly effective technique developed at SEER was walling. You wrap a towel around someone's neck to support their head, then bang them up against a specially constructed wall.
You know, you do it on a fake wall, right? But it's got a clapper behind it, and it makes a tremendous amount of noise, and there's a lot of give, and your ears start swirling, and you don't do it in a way to cause damage to the person, I suppose you could if you were a goon, right? But look at me, I'm not going to bounce somebody off a wall hard enough to, it's like a wrestling mat, only louder. Not painful, it's just confusing. You know, it's disruptive to your train of thought.
Mitchell's responsibility was to help design the SEER program, and that meant he occasionally went through the training protocol himself. Once, he says, he was part of a SEER exercise involving one of the oldest tricks in the interrogation business. The interrogator threatens not the subject, but a colleague of the subject's. In Mitchell's experience, men and women react very differently to this scenario. The men tend to fold. The women don't.
If you were a female pilot and they said they were going to do something to some other airman, the attitude of a lot of them was, it sucks to be you. You know, you do your job, I'm going to do mine, I'm going to protect the secrets. I'm sorry this has happened to you, but, you know, you knew this when you signed up.
Mitchell first saw this when he debriefed women who had been held as POWs during Desert Storm.
They would drag those women out and threaten to beat them every time the men wouldn't talk. They were angry at the men for not holding out. And they said, maybe I would have gotten a beating. Maybe I would have got sexually molested, but it would have happened one time. It would have happened one time. By showing them that the way to get the keys to the kingdom was to drag me out, it happened every time. And so let me do my job. You do your job.
In the SEER exercise, Mitchell was paired with a woman, a senior-ranking Air Force officer. Her interrogators said they would torture Mitchell unless she talked. True to form, she said, I'm not talking.
They put me in a 55-gallon drum that was buried in the ground, filled it up with water, and covered me up with dirt. put a lid on it and covered it up with dirt. Now, what they did that I didn't know at the time, because they just stuck a running hose in it and you just sit there where the water came up, right? Is they had, unbeknownst to me, because of the way they positioned me, drain holes at the very top before it got to my nose.
Slowly, the barrel filled with water.
I'm pretty sure they wouldn't kill the next psychologist to come to the, you know, to come to the school. I was pretty sure of that, but I wasn't convinced of that. You know what I mean?
So, Jesus, how did you feel when that was happening?
I wasn't happy because, you know, your knees are up against your chest and you can't get out. Your arms are down beside you. You can't move. You know, they put a strap underneath you and lower you into the thing.
At what point were you removed?
An hour or so later, you know.
How high was the water?
It comes right up to your nose. It comes right up to here. So you really don't know. I mean, the thing's coming up around your neck. It's coming up around your ears. I don't know if they still do it, but they did it at that time. The phobia.
You're in darkness.
Oh, yeah. Maybe it wasn't an hour. Maybe it was less than that. I'm sure it was. Otherwise, I'd have some hypothermia. Felt like an hour. So I gave you my subjective experience instead of real time. That's interesting. Anyway, I'm in this thing, and they lower you down, and I think, oh, they're going to put me in a barrel, you know, see if I'm claustrophobic. I'm not, so no big deal to me. Oh, no. They stick the hose in, put the lid on, put that little metal lid on, and then cover it up with rocks.
Do they tell you beforehand what they're going to do?
They tell you as they're doing it.
Everything they were doing to the trainees at SEER, they did to you as well.
Oh, yeah.
As Mitchell put it, a lot of people spent time in that barrel. At the time, that was part of the standard course.
I took the advanced course, and if you think the basic course is rough, dude.
Here is where the CIA's enhanced interrogation program came from. The CIA came to Mitchell and Jessen and asked for their advice. The two of them had been working for years, designing and implementing what they believed to be the most effective interrogation technique imaginable, and the agency wanted to know what worked. So Mitchell and Jessen made a list, at the top of which was sleep deprivation, walling, and waterboarding. Waterboarding is where you're placed on a gurney with your head lower than your feet, a cloth is placed over your face, and water is poured into your mouth and nose to produce the sensation of drowning. As it happened, waterboarding was one of the few techniques Mitchell and Jessen didn't use at SEER. From the Air Force's perspective, waterboarding was too good. They were trying to teach their people that resisting torture was possible, so it made little sense to expose them to a technique that, for most people, made resistance impossible. But to use unsuspected terrorists? To many in the CIA, it made sense. As a precautionary step, he and Jessen tried it out on themselves first, each waterboarding the other, two sessions in total for each of them, using the most aggressive protocol, the 40-second continuous pour.
So describe what it was like.
You ever been on a super tall building and thought you might jump off, knowing you wouldn't jump off, but thought you might jump off? That's what it felt like to me. I didn't feel like I was going to die. I felt like I was afraid I was going to die.
When the Justice Department sent two senior attorneys to the interrogation site to confirm the legality of the techniques under consideration, Mitchell and Jessen waterboarded them too. One of the lawyers, he remembers, sat up afterward, dried her hair, and said simply, "Well, that sucked." Mitchell and Jessen developed a protocol. If a detainee was reluctant to answer questions, they would start with the mildest of enhanced measures. If the detainee persisted, they would escalate. Walling was a favorite, as was sleep deprivation. The Justice Department's rules were that 72 hours of sleep deprivation was the maximum. But Mitchell and Jessen found that unnecessary. What they preferred to do was let someone sleep, but not sleep enough, to systematically break up their REM cycles. Waterboarding was the technique of last resort. They used a hospital gurney tilted at 45 degrees. The Justice Department allowed them to pour water at 20 to 40 second intervals, separated by 3 breaths for a total of 20 minutes. They preferred 1 40-second pour, 2 20-second pours, and the remainder at 3 to 10 seconds.
We have no interest in drowning a person at all. We originally used water out of a 1-liter bottle, but the physicians wanted us to use saline because some people swallowed the water and they didn't want to have water intoxication.
Before the first pour, they took a black T-shirt and lowered it over the subject's face, covering their nose. The cloth goes like this, Mitchell said, miming the lowering of the shirt.
And literally, when you lift the cloth up, the pourer stops pouring. And there's a guy up there with a stopwatch, and he's counting the seconds, right? So I know how many seconds is going on. We got a physician right there.
The interrogation room was crowded. Typically, the chief of base would be there, the intelligence analyst responsible for the case, and a psychologist, among others. Another group was outside, watching the proceedings on a large video monitor. More CIA experts, a lawyer, guards, a big group. No questions were asked during the process. That was for later.
You're not screaming at the guy, you know. I mean, literally, you're pouring the water and you're saying to him in a not quite conversational tone, but not an aggressive tone, it doesn't have to be this way. You know, we want information to stop operations inside the United States. We know you don't have all of it, but we know you have some of it.
That's what you're saying.
While we're doing it, I'm saying it to him. Mm-hmm. As this happening, it doesn't have to be this way. This is your choice.
How do you know, in general with EITs, how do you know when you've gone as far as you need to go?
They start talking to you.
By talking, Mitchell means specifics, details, names, facts. For instance, when shown a photograph.
Giving that picture and say, who's this guy? And you say, well, this guy is this guy. But, you know, the guy in the back is this guy. And this is where he's at. And this is what his expertise is. And, you know, so he would go beyond the question that you ask him at some point.
Mitchell and Jessen focused on compliance. They wanted their subjects to talk and volunteer information and answer questions. And from the beginning with KSM, they were convinced they would need every technique in their arsenal to get him to talk. He wasn't a foot soldier on the fringes of Al-Qaeda, someone ambivalent about his participation in terrorist acts. Foot soldiers are easy. They have little to say and little to lose by saying it. They'll cooperate with their interrogators because they realize it is their best chance of winning their freedom. But KSM knew he wasn't seeing daylight again, ever. He had no incentive to cooperate. Mitchell knew all the psychological interrogation techniques used by the people who didn't believe in enhanced interrogation, and he thought they would work just fine on what he called common terrorists that you catch on the battlefield, like the everyday jihadists that were fighting Americans. But not on the hardcore guys. And KSM was a hardcore guy. Mitchell and Jessen could use only walling and sleep deprivation to get him to talk because, incredibly, waterboarding did not work on KSM. Somehow KSM was able to open his sinuses and the water that flowed into his nose would simply flow out his mouth. No one understood how he did it. Mitchell calls it a magic trick. After a few sessions, KSM grasped how long they would pour the water. He would mock the room by counting down the remaining seconds on his fingers, then making a slashing gesture with his hand when it was over. Once, in the middle of a session, Mitchell and Jessen ducked out of the room to confer with a colleague. When they came back inside, KSM was snoring.
He was asleep. I thought to myself, well, now, there is a piece of this that I know I'm laughing at this potentially horrific image that people have, but there was a piece of this. I've never heard of it. I'm telling you, when the CIA was doing due diligence, they called JPRA, the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency.
JPRA is a Pentagon agency that monitors the various SEER programs run by the service branches. They had a file on waterboarding. Mitchell says, the person they talked to there said that it's 100% effective on our students. We have never had anyone not capitulate. Mitchell and Jessen gave KSM the full treatment for 3 weeks. Finally, he stopped resisting. But KSM's hard-won compliance didn't mean his case was now open and shut. In fact, the difficulties were just beginning. A few years before 9/11, a psychiatrist named Charles Morgan was at a military neuroscience conference. He was researching post-traumatic stress syndrome. trying to understand why some veterans suffer from PTSD and why others who go through exactly the same experiences emerge unscathed. Morgan was talking to his colleagues about how hard it was to study the question, because what you really wanted to do was to identify a group of people before they had a traumatic experience and track their reactions in real time. But how could you do that? There was no war going on at the time, and it wasn't as though he could arrange for all his research subjects to simultaneously get robbed at gunpoint or suffer some devastating loss. Morgan jokes that the best idea he could come up with was to study couples on the eve of their wedding day. But afterward, an Army colonel came to Morgan and said, "I think I can solve your problem." The colonel worked at a SEER school at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It was the Army's version of the Air Force school in Spokane, where Jessen and Mitchell worked.
We drove out in a little car way out, you know, at Fort Bragg.
That's Charles Morgan. He goes on.
I remember it was a foggy little day in a little car, and we're riding along, take little trails that are unmarked and everything, and then we end up in this spot. And for all the world, it sort of looked like the set from Hogan's Heroes. You know, you pull up, and there's a mini concentration camp. And in the fog, I couldn't tell how big it was or not. There was nothing running at the time, so there were students there. They weren't running a course at the time. So it was this, like, abandoned concentration camp appearing thing.
The Army had built a replica of a prisoner of war camp, the kind you might find in North Korea or some distant corner of the old Soviet Union.
And they walked me through and described all the different dilemmas that they expose students to, so they have an opportunity to demonstrate that they know how to adhere to the Geneva Convention and the Code of Conduct rules if they're captured.
Morgan was fascinated, but skeptical. He was interested in traumatic stress. SEER School was a realistic simulation of what it meant to be captured and interrogated by the enemy, but it was still just a simulation. At the end of the day, all the participants were still in North Carolina, and they could still go on and get a beer and watch a movie with their friends when they were done. How could they be truly stressed, as in a combat situation?
It's hard to believe at first. You're like, well, they know they're in a course, so they know it's training, and the training can be rigorous, but still, it wouldn't feel like uncontrollable stress, which is most of the animal models for PTSD.
The SEER instructors just smiled at that. They invited him to come and monitor for a 6-month period. Morgan started with the interrogation phase of the training, taking blood and saliva samples from the soldiers after they had been questioned. Here is how Morgan describes the results in the scientific journal Biological Psychiatry. The realistic stress of the training laboratory produced rapid and profound changes in cortisol, testosterone, and thyroid hormones. These alterations were of a magnitude that is comparable to those documented in individuals undergoing physical stressors such as major surgery or actual combat. This was a pretend interrogation. The sessions lasted half an hour. A number of the subjects were Green Berets and Special Forces, the cream of the crop, and they were reacting as if they were in actual combat. Morgan watched in shock as one soldier after another broke down in tears.
You could look at some people, and you could see that they'd dissociated, that you had to snap your finger to get their attention. Yeah, some people would tear up and cry. Other people didn't, but you could tell they were enormously stressed.
These were soldiers, organized, disciplined, motivated. And Morgan realized that it was the uncertainty of their situation that was unsettling to them. Their internal alarm bells were going off, even in a controlled situation. Then he decided to have the SEER students do what is called the Ray Osterett complex figure drawing test.
So when you see this, you know, you've got this box with a, it almost looks like a sail on top and the triangle here.
First, you have to copy the image. Then the original is taken away and you have to draw it from memory.
There's one where it's in two colors. Adults, so we give them a pen, and then about either 30 seconds or 40 seconds into it, we say flip the pen over so it changes color. And what you'll see with adults is the first color you've given them will be all of these large features like the box and the big X that cuts across it. And all these little details, the little lines and things like this are always in the second color. So people have done the big picture of the forest, then they add the trees.
Most adults are pretty good at this task, and they use the same strategy. They start by drawing the outlines of the figure, then fill in the details. Children, on the other hand, use a piecemeal approach. They randomly do one chunk of the drawing, then move on to another bit.
They start at one side, and they just incrementally work their way across the drawing. So when you switch the color, it looks like you've just cut the picture in half, and it's changed color. So in that paper, if people look at it, they'll see the picture where like it's just half in red and half in black.
Before interrogations, the Seer students sailed through the test with flying colors. Being able to quickly memorize and reproduce a complex visual display, after all, is the kind of thing Green Beret and Special Operations soldiers are trained to do.
So even though they've been sleep deprived, they drew the picture in the normal adult manner, and they would get many more of the components. Whereas under stress, they would draw the picture in these bifurcated colors, so they would look like a prepubescent human. And then in the recall, they would have poor recall for the constituent parts.
It was, he says, like a prepubescent kid, which means your prefrontal cortex has just shut down for a while. For anyone in the interrogation business, Morgan's work was deeply troubling. The point of the interrogation was to get the subject to talk, to crack open the subject's memory and access whatever was inside. But what if the process of securing compliance proved so stressful to the interviewee that it affected what he or she could actually remember? Morgan was watching adults turn into children.
I'll never forget, even when I was collecting like spit samples from one of the students, 20 minutes later when the experience was over, we're all still standing in the same area of the training compound because they do a whole ceremony of welcoming people back home, and it's very moving. And the student I had just been talking to and testing looked at me and goes, "When did you arrive? Like, did you just get here?" And I went, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, I haven't seen you the entire time, and I remember 2.5 weeks ago, you were here and told us you would come see us while we were in training and collect samples." They went, "I just was talking to you 20 minutes ago. And they went, "I don't remember."
Morgan was so astonished that he decided to run a quick field test. He put together the equivalent of a police lineup, filling it with instructors, officers, and a few stray outsiders. He also put in the physician for the unit, who had just returned from vacation the day before. Then Morgan gave his instructions to the soldiers who had recently undergone stressful questioning. He told them, "We're really interested in the person who ran the camp and ordered all your punishments. If they're here, please indicate who they are. If they're not, just say, 'Not here.'" He wanted them to identify the commandant, the man in charge. Out of the 52 students, 20 of them instead picked the doctor. And the doctor said, "I wasn't here. I was in Hawaii." If one of the soldiers had gotten it wrong, it would have been understandable. People make mistakes. So would 2 misidentifications, or even 3. But 20 got it wrong. In any court of law, the hapless physician would end up behind bars. After 9/11, Morgan went to work for the CIA. There, he tried to impress upon his colleagues the significance of his findings. The agency had spies and confidential sources all around the world. They had information gathered from people they had captured or coerced into cooperating. These sources were people who often spoke with great confidence. Some were highly trusted. Some gave information that was considered very credible. But Morgan's point was that if the information they were sharing had been obtained under stress, what they said might be inaccurate or misleading, and the sources wouldn't know it. They would say, "It's the doctor. I know it was the doctor," even though the doctor was 1,000 miles away. Morgan says, "I said to the other analysts, You know, the implication of this is really alarming. So what did Charles Morgan think when he heard about what James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen were up to with KSM in their faraway black site?
The argument early on had been, well, maybe this is the way to get information from people. My view, I was pretty vocal at the time. I said, I just don't see it. I do think that's like, you know, damaging your radio and hoping you get better signals.
KSM may have felt like it was torture, but the fact was that the enhanced interrogation program signed off on by the Justice Department using techniques we used on our own people in training. It wasn't torture, no matter what anybody said. It was a good, legitimate program that let us develop the intelligence we had to have to keep America safe for 7.5 years.
That's the former Vice President, Dick Cheney, recorded by C-SPAN in 2013. KSM made his first public confession on the afternoon of March 10th, 2007, just over 4 years after he was captured by the CIA in Islamabad, Pakistan. The occasion was a tribunal hearing held at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. There were 8 people present in addition to KSM, a personal representative assigned to the prisoner, a linguist, and officers from each of the 4 branches of the U.S. military service. KSM was asked if he understood the nature of the proceedings. He said he did. A description of the charges against him was read out loud. Through his representative, he made a few small corrections. "My name is misspelled in the summary of evidence," he said. "It should be S-H-A-I-K-H or S-H-E-I-K-H, but not S-H-A-Y-K-H as it is in the subject line." He asked for a translation of a verse from the Quran. A few more matters of administration were discussed. Then KSM's personal representative read his confession. "I hereby admit and affirm without duress to the following. I swore allegiance to Sheikh Osama bin Laden to conduct jihad. I was the operational director for Sheikh Osama bin Laden for the organizing, planning, follow-up, and execution of the 9/11 operation. I was directly in charge of managing and following up on the cell for the production of biological weapons, such as anthrax and others, and following up on dirty bomb operations on American soil." Then KSM listed every single Al-Qaeda operation of which he had been, in his words, either a responsible participant, principal planner, trainer, financier, executor, and or personal participant. There were 31 items on that list. The Sears Tower in Chicago, Heathrow Airport, Big Ben in London, countless U.S. and Israeli embassies, assassination attempts on Bill Clinton and Pope John Paul II, and on in horrifying detail. Here, for example, are items 25 to 27. "I was responsible for surveillance needed to hit nuclear power plants that generate electricity in several U.S. states. I was responsible for planning, surveying, and financing to hit NATO headquarters in Europe." The statement ended. The judge turned to KSM. "Before you proceed, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the statement that was just read by the personal representative, were those your words?" KSM said they were, then launched into a long, impassioned explanation of his actions. "He was simply a warrior," he said, "engaged in combat no different from any other soldier. War start from Adam, when Cain he killed Abel, until now. It's never going to stop killing of people. This is the way of the language. Americans start the Revolutionary War when they start the Mexican then Spanish War, and on and on." KSM's extraordinary confession was a triumph for Mitchell and Jessen. The man who had come to them in 2003, angry and defiant, was now willingly laying his past bare. But KSM's cooperation left a crucial question unanswered. Was what he said true? Once someone has been subjected to that kind of stress, they are in Charles Morgan territory. Was KSM confessing to all those crimes just to get Mitchell and Jessen to stop? By some accounts, Mitchell and Jessen had disrupted and denied KSM sleep for a week. And after all that abuse, did KSM know what his real memories were anymore? In his book, Why Torture Doesn't Work, neuroscientist Shane O'Mara writes that extended sleep deprivation, quote, might induce some form of surface compliance, but only at the cost of long-term structural remodeling of the brain systems that support the very functions that the interrogator wishes to have access to. Former high-ranking CIA officer Robert Baer read the confession and concluded that KSM was making things up. One of the targets he listed was the Plaza Bank building in downtown Seattle. But Plaza Bank wasn't founded as a company until years after KSM's arrest. Another longtime CIA veteran, Bruce Rydell, argued that the very thing that made it hard to get KSM to cooperate in the first place, the fact that he was never getting out of prison, is also what made his claims suspect. He has nothing else in life but to be remembered as a famous terrorist, Rydell said. He wants to promote his own importance. It's been a problem since he was captured. If he was going to spend the rest of his days in a prison cell, why not make a play for the history books? KSM's confession went on and on. I was responsible for planning, training, surveying, and financing for the operation to bomb and destroy the Panama Canal, he said. I was responsible for surveying and financing for the assassination of several former American presidents, including President Carter. Was there anything KSM did not claim credit for? None of these critics questioned the need to interrogate KSM. The fact that strangers are hard to understand doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Ponzi schemers and pedophiles can't be allowed to roam free. The Italian police had a responsibility to understand Amanda Knox. And why did Neville Chamberlain make such an effort to meet Hitler? Because with the threat of World War looming, trying to make peace with your enemy is essential. But the harder we work at getting strangers to reveal themselves, the more elusive they become. Chamberlain would have been better off never meeting Hitler at all. He should have stayed home and read Mein Kampf. The police in the Sandusky case searched high and low for his victims for 2 years. What did their efforts yield? Not clarity, but confusion. Stories that changed, allegations that surfaced and then disappeared, victims who were bringing their own children to meet Sandusky one minute, then accusing him of terrible crimes the next. James Mitchell was in the same position. The CIA had reason to believe that Al-Qaeda was planning a second round of attacks after 9/11, possibly involving nuclear weapons. He had to get KSM to talk. But the harder he worked to get KSM to talk, the more he compromised the quality of their communication. He could deprive KSM of sleep for a week, at the end of which KSM was confessing to every crime under the sun. But did KSM really want to blow up the Panama Canal? Whatever it is we are trying to find out about the strangers in our midst is not something robust. The truth about Amanda Knox or Jerry Sandusky or KSM is not some hard and shiny object that can be extracted if only we dig deep enough and look hard enough. The thing we want to learn about a stranger is fragile. If we tread carelessly, it will crumple under our feet. And from that follows a second cautionary note. We need to accept that the search to understand a stranger has real limits. We will never know the whole truth. We have to be satisfied with something short of that. The right way to talk to strangers is with caution and humility. How many of the crises and controversies I have described would have been prevented had we taken those lessons to heart? We are now close to returning to the events of that day in Prairie View, Texas, when Brian and Cynia pulled over Sandra Bland. But before we do, we have one last thing to consider, the strangely overlooked phenomenon of coupling. Part 5, Prairie View, Texas. Chapter 10, Sylvia Plath. In the fall of 1962, the American poet Sylvia Plath left her cottage in the English countryside for London. She needed a fresh start. Her husband, Ted Hughes, had abandoned her for another woman, leaving her alone with their two small children. She found an apartment in London's Primrose Hill neighborhood, the top two floors of a townhouse. "I am writing from London, so happy I can hardly speak," she told her mother.